Welcome to another Mother Runner. This is Sarah Bowen Shea. I'm joined today by Amanda Loudon. Hello, Amanda.
Hey, Sarah. How are you?
Oh, good. It was very funny. When I come into the studio, I walk past my husband, whose home office is in the basement as well. And he was like, oh, what you up to? I said, oh, go and record the podcast. He said, don't you usually do that on Wednesday? And I'm like, it is Wednesday.
And everyone knows the day of the week.
Yeah. He's maybe been in the basement a little too long. Oh, my goodness. Well, I ran 2.25 miles this morning, but I hear you are struggling with an injury.
Yeah, you know, I've been very, very fortunate and have not been injured in eons. And I was running trails a couple of weeks ago, and I think I already had like a little bit of underlying tightness, like in my glute, ITB area. And I tripped and fell. And I think, and my PT thinks, it wasn't necessarily the impact of falling so much as how I braced as I went down. Mm. And it's kind of jacked up like the joint between my tibia and fibula, and also kind of, you know, like the IT band and all that. So I don't know. I tried to, you know, I gave it a couple days of trying to run, and it just really, you know, just going downstairs was really painful and things like that. Mm. So I you know, had a kind of good PT evaluation over the weekend to kind of put me on the right course. And I'm just modifying all my workouts and all that kind of stuff right now to kind of get it to calm down. And it's super calmed down already. Like I'm really pleased with how quickly it's, you know, kind of responding to all of this. So hopefully it's not going to be a long layoff, you know, cause I mean, I don't do well when I'm not right. I mean, I'm, you know, preaching to the entire choir. Right. And you've had you've had this very long injury, so I'm not going to whine to you. So
yeah, no. Your pain is genuine. That you know, just because there's other people suffering, quote unquote, worse, doesn't mean that your suffering isn't real.
I know.
So you told me on email yesterday that it's taken you to an ugly place emotionally. So share a little bit of that.
I don't know. I think you know what? When I was like in my 40s, I went through a lot of injuries, and one time I did have an ITB injury that lasted forever and a day. And so I think we all we all go back to our history and our experience. And so like when I hear ITB and when I think it's ITB, even though it's on the other leg, it doesn't matter. It takes me back to like, oh my God, am I going to be like stuck, you know, just in a pool and, you know, what, and nothing wrong with those things, but it's not what we want to be doing, right, as runners. And it just kind of makes me like, it makes me stressed and sad and depressed and angry and all those things, you know? So it just, I need to like go, hey, it's a new experience. You've learned a lot since back then. You've got good PTs who have a handle on all those things, you know? I need to take myself back there and focus on this little bit of progress. Like I think the first couple of days I felt like, oh my gosh, I haven't run in a week and I haven't progressed. I'm not feeling any better. And that makes me really kind of, you know, that stuck place is a bad place.
Yeah. And I find for me during the worst of my bulging disc thing, it was that not knowing each day when you wake up, how is it going to be? Am I going to be able to make it to the bathroom, like without limping horribly or holding onto the door frame? Ugh. And, you know, just, I don't know. It's one thing to wake up and not know whether it's raining or cold or windy outside, but to be like, how is my body going to be feeling today?
Yeah.
And what's my reality? I think my reality is going to be driving carpool and then taking a Zoom call and all those things. But how is my body going to fit into that scheme?
Right. It's just not a place where, you know, it's not, I don't know. It's not our picture of ourselves, you know, of who we are and, you know, all that. Yeah.
Yeah, this week is the past couple of days have been the 8-year anniversary of when I fractured my ankle in four places and had plates and pins put in, a plate and pins. And oh my gosh, like it was actually kind of good because I'd forgotten. And then, but then on May 1st, that was the day it happened. My husband reminded me. thanks, honey. Couldn't we just call it May Day and be good with it? get out our Soviet hats and dance around a maple. Yeah. But then I tried. So, and May 6th was the anniversary of my surgery, but it was also the day that one of our friends had their first baby and they'd been trying for a long time to have a baby. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to focus on the fact that it's, you know, quote unquote, baby Ray's birthday, who's now, I don't know. So he was 8. I do know how old he was. And so, so I tried to focus on the happy anniversary of that date rather than the wah, wah. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but you're making progress. So tell us about that.
Yes. So now ran 3 miles yesterday. And that was truly the first day where I felt like my quote unquote, old, my previous self. And just because there's always been kind of a little hitch in my giddy up particularly when I stop, let's say I don't know, you know, want to come to the end of a podcast and want to switch to another or something like that. To when I actually stop running, I kind of pull up almost like a horse would, and it's the feeling in my inner thighs. And then to start again, the first couple steps feel kind of creaky, and I didn't have any of that yesterday, which was pretty exciting.
That's so nice.
And then, yeah. And then afterwards during the work day, you know, when I got up from being seated for too long, I didn't walk like my, you know, dad did when he was 92. Love my dad, but boy, he was what he calls stove up. So, yes. So, and then I play pickleball league on Wednesday night. So I don't do too much exercise in the morning, but I was like, oh, I feel it's a beautiful day here. And so I went out and ran what ended up being 2.25 miles and listened to music instead of a podcast. So yeah. Olivia Rodrigo was my running companion this morning.
Excellent. So,
yeah.
Oh, that sounds so good. And it sounds like you're heading in the right direction. And I think one of the things you just said that's so key is I think one of the things about injury and returning from injury, it's not even necessarily how you're feeling during the run. It's like that, you know, those next 24 hours. That's a great, I think, mm-hmm. you know, like judgment of how you're progressing. And so if you're feeling good when you're, you know, like you said, getting up from sitting after a while of, you know, later mm-hmm. after running, that's all really mm-hmm. positive.
Yes. Yes. For me, that is definitely the test of it, is that it doesn't, you know, even when I was trying to come back or like last fall, I didn't have too much pain while I was running, but afterwards I'd just be a wreck. And so now to be like, hey, look at me. I need something in the basement. I'm going to just, you know, jog down the stairs and come right back up without having to pause. Like, that's amazing. So, you know, I definitely, we have a refrigerator down here in the basement. There was a lot last year. Hey, can you run down and get the blue yogurt, you know, the yogurt in the blue container or the, you know, shredded coconut out of the fridge down there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, mom. Oh. Oh my goodness. Well, you recommended today's guest. She is Christine Yu, an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in Runner's World, Self, Outside Magazine, and more. She focuses on the intersection of sports science and women athletes, which is exactly what her new book is about. It's called Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes, which debuts next week. Christine is a longtime runner, a yoga instructor, and a surfer. She's also a mom of 2 teen sons, and she and her family live in Brooklyn. Thanks for joining us, Christine, and congratulations on your fabulous book.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited too, because I just do have to say that Christine and I are kind of freelancing colleagues, and we go way back with running blogs in the day. So it's been really exciting for me to kind of see her trajectory with her career and see her land where she is today. So Christine, why don't you tell us a little bit about your running background?
Yeah, so I am 100% recreational runner. I started running, you know, I think really the senior year of high school. I mean, I'd played sports all my life, so ran as part of soccer and field hockey and all of that stuff, but really kind of running for running's sake my senior year in high school, because senior spring for my PE requirement, you could do community service. And so I decided to do that senior spring. But as part of that, you also had to do like 30 minutes of what they called basics. And so most people just kind of walked around the outdoor track. But me and two of my friends decided to start running. Oh, I have no idea why we did this. But it was like the first time that I'd really started to do that. And then I ran more, again, just mostly for exercise, right? In college and then after college. And it was really, I think, after college that I started to do races and, ran a couple of marathons and all of that. But yeah, running has been kind of a steady piece of life. It's, for sure started off as like exercise and lose weight and all of that stuff, mm-hmm. but has become much more, I feel like, of a grounding practice.
Mm-hmm. Nice. I love that. And so, unfortunately, we know you haven't been running the past few months. So tell everyone a little bit about your sidelining injury this year.
My current predicament. Right. I tore my ACL skiing in February, which in and of itself stinks, but it's actually my third ACL tear. So I've torn my ACL twice in my right knee, and then this tear is in my left knee. So now my knees are even. Yeah, so I'm a bit sidelined right now, kind of doing mostly physical therapy to see if I could potentially not undergo surgery, but I have a feeling that I'm probably going to end up getting surgery in the fall.
Wow. Wow. I didn't know that you could, quote unquote, cure a torn ACL without surgery. That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily curing it, right? Like, but it's just building up more of the muscles to support the joint. Theoretically, when I was talking to my doctor, especially for sure if you're younger or whatnot, but you can get away with not having an ACL. It largely depends on not just your body, but also just lifestyle and goals and all of that, what you want to do. So, we kind of were talking about that. I mean, the only reason really that I don't necessarily want to do it is because the thought of having to undergo, I mean, this would be like my fourth major surgery and having to recover from it is just really daunting. Mm-hmm. And just thinking about, do I have that in me? But then at the same time, I love being active, right? Like I love skiing and, with two bum knees, I'm not sure that I'd still be able to do it really, mm-hmm. Or if it necessarily would be smart. So if I want to, and I'm not ready to give up skiing. I'm probably leaning towards getting it done.
All right. Well, skiing on water in a way. Surfing. I love that you took up surfing when you were in your 30s. So talk to us about how you did that and what the sport does for you and where it's taken you. You sent a gnarly photo of you surfing Costa Rica.
Yeah. So, this was totally by accident. My husband and I decided to take a vacation. It was the first solo vacation we were taking after, I have two boys. So after the kids were born, and I think my youngest was maybe one, somewhere around there. And we were trying to figure out where to go. I mean, we've both traveled a lot, but we've never been to Costa Rica. And so when we were talking about this with some friends, everyone kept saying, well, if you're going to go to Costa Rica, you should go surfing. Neither of us have surfed before. So my husband found this incredible surf camp there where we were there for a week. And both of us just fell in love with it, which was kind of surprising. And, since then, he surfs more consistently than I do. But it's kind of become part of our lives. Part of it was it's so rare to learn something new as an adult and to be so utterly clueless. And, it was you're just bad at something. And having to learn that as an adult, I think, is just an incredible experience, right? It not only is humbling, but I think it really teaches you some flexibility, just, your mental, how you approach things mentally, obviously physically as well. But yeah, it's an experience unlike any other when you do catch a wave and you have that momentum behind you, it literally feels like you're flying through the air. Mm. Yeah. So we've gone back to Costa Rica with the kids. My husband mostly, surfs a bunch here in New York and out in the Rockaways. I'm more of a warm weather surfer. So we actually spend a bunch of time out in Hawaii in the summers with our kids. I say it's the excuse to get the kids out of the city and get them into nature, away from the concrete. But really, it started off because we fell in love with surfing. My husband found this surf break out in Oahu that he adores. And so we just go there so we can, so he can surf primarily, I can surf some, and then we can get some fresh air.
Oh my goodness. Hawaii is a magical place. So you don't have to have an excuse to go there. Oh my goodness. So a few weeks, this is taking a little bit of a side tangent, but a few weeks ago we had a guest on who was Cambodian American, and I asked her about being a woman of color in the running world. Mm. And she said she hadn't really noticed how white the sport of running is. So as an Asian American yourself, does it strike you that most runners are Caucasian, and have you ever felt othered while running?
It definitely does strike me as a very white sport. It's something that I probably didn't realize for a long time. I grew up in Connecticut in Fairfield County, which is a very white.
Sorry, I grew up in Stamford.
Oh, I grew up in Trumbull. Uh-huh. Went to school in Westport. So, I mean, you know, from when I was young, I've always been surrounded, right, by white classmates, white peers, you know, white families and all of that. And definitely, you know, felt like I had to keep my Chinese side of me to like myself in a way, except if my mom was making like dumplings for my friends. And then it was like a big deal and everybody was really excited. But I do, because I think it's in part that, you know, especially when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, there weren't a lot of, there wasn't a lot of representation of Asian athletes outside of, say, gymnastics or figure skating, right? Or something like that. I didn't see a lot of role models out there, coupled with, you know, my mom, while I played sports all my life, my mom was always kind of a little bit wary in a sense, because if I was out in the sun, it would make me too dark, or I would get, my muscles would get too big. Like, she would always ask me, like, why are you lifting weights? Or why are you running so much? What do you, you know, why are you doing that? So it was always kind of seen as like this weird thing. But yeah, but I do feel like there isn't, it's gotten better, but, you know, historically there doesn't seem to be a lot of representation from the Asian community. You know, again, because we're not associated with being like the athletic ones, if you will. I trying to think in terms of answering your question about of being othered. I don't think it's ever an overt thing that someone is doing purposefully, right? Mm-hmm. I think that it's in part some of just the culture around the sport. So I can think of times when like I'll show up like at a group run, or I've been to a group run or something like that, but not feeling welcomed in that space. And, you know, I'm not saying like, oh, everybody has to come and talk to me or say hi to me or whatever, but it there are, you know, some aspects of it feeling very clicky in a way that brought me back to middle school, frankly. And it's in part why, like, I don't like running in groups and I don't like doing group runs, because not only do I just feel self-conscious about my own like running and pace and all of that, but I also feel like, I don't know, like this weird combination of, oh, I don't really belong here, or if, you know, kind of not pity, but something along those lines, right? Like it's never really made me feel very comfortable.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh, it's, yeah. I'm like, oh, it's fine.
So, Christine, take us back in time, and what first got you interested in the topic of sports science and women athletes?
Yeah, so, I mean, science has always been something that I've been super interested in. The plan was that I was going to go to medical school and I was going to be a doctor after college. So, you know, I've taken it and I did all of that, did my whole, like all the pre-med requirements. So it's always fascinated, like the human body has always fascinated me in terms of, you know, how we do the things that we do. And like I said, like growing up playing sports and growing up watching a lot of sports, I've always just been fascinated by athletes and their ability to perform. And then along the way, right, because I tend to be injury prone, becoming more curious too about like, well, how do we prevent injury? Mostly from a selfish perspective, right? Like, how do I keep myself doing these things that I want to do? But long story short, I obviously didn't go to medical school. I also didn't get a journalism degree. And like Amanda said, I started this blog actually after my husband and I went to the surf camp in Costa Rica. And that's how I kind of got back into writing. And I realized that I could kind of combine these two interests of mine of sports and women and science in a way that I hadn't realized was possible. And so kind of from there, I'd started freelance writing a bit for a couple of different outlets and eventually got this opportunity to really start digging in deeper into athletes and sports performance and what's going on there and what might be different, right, when we're looking at a female population versus a male population. And it was really, again, going to some of these events in New York City, you know, they have all these events for magazine editors and freelance writers, and going to one of these and listening to someone talk about the female athlete triad. And again, growing up, you know so many people who have struggled with eating disorders and disordered eating, you know, had always kind of took it as fact that if you lost your period, you're faster, you're really fit. Mm-hmm. But hearing someone actually talk about this and how that's related to, you know, how your menstrual cycle is related to eating and bone health particularly was like blew my mind away in the sense that how I just couldn't, I was like, why doesn't anyone tell me, like, talk about this? Or why haven't I heard this before? But also from the perspective of theoretically, like, I'm taking all these classes. I was prepared to go to medical school, right, to continue learning about this or, you know, potentially treating patients. But why don't we talk about any of this stuff? And so that really kind of got me, you know, down this rabbit hole of trying to understand what are the barriers, why, you know, just generally, why don't we know as much about women and our bodies? And, you know, frankly, why don't we talk about this? What are, you know, what is keeping us from teaching people about what's going on? Really, what those repercussions might be.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So your book comes out in what seems like a golden age of books written by strong athletic women, Allison Mariella Desir, Kara Goucher, Lauren Fleshman, Des Linden. So what's it been like to share the stage and the spotlight with those folks?
It's a little intimidating. you know, they are all just such incredible women doing amazing things. I mean, I will be honest, like at first when I, you know, when I first heard that all these books were coming out, I was really excited, right? Because we've never had this many books, especially within this short period of time, come out. But then I got really scared because I'm at the end, right? Like, and so I was somewhat worried that would people be sick of this by the time
with the wave of crested and
like, are, you know, will people be done, you know, reading about women athletes and women's sports by the time May comes around? So that part of me kind of was a little worried. But to be honest, like, it's been really incredible because all of our books are very different, right? You know, the other four are primarily, you know, kind of personal experience. Allison's, you know, weaves in a lot more kind of history and social cultural stuff. Lauren weaves in some of the science too. But we were, minus Des, we were all on stage together at the Boston Marathon Expo talking. And it was really cool just because it was like all of our books were in conversation with each other. We were all ultimately talking about the same thing, right? Like, we all love the sport. We all want to make it better. And we all want to make it better for like the future generations. And we're coming at it from different angles, but being able to see it on stage together was really cool. Just this like holistic approach, if you will.
I love you saying that that all the books were in conversation with each other, and that sometimes I think of it as like an immersion class, you know, so that I'll sometimes, I don't know, like get really fascinated with like the Waco tragedy or something like that. And so I'll watch one documentary and then listen to a podcast and then read a book about it and a New Yorker article and all this stuff. So I kind of feel that people could almost do a great books course all on their own of the five books. So I hope people do that. And I mean, yours came out a month after Dez's. Like, that. I don't think the ground has shifted that much underneath our feet.
I hope so. And I mean, frankly, I think what my book does, or you know, what I hope my book does, is provide a bit more context to around these other stories, because mine isn't just about, you know, a personal narrative. It incorporates a lot of anecdotes and stories and interviews from scientists and athletes across the spectrum. But my hope is that it provides a bit of that wider lens on the environment and the systems in which Lauren is working within and Kara was and Des was, you know, just to be able to provide that context a little bit more, because I think it's so easy to take, like, you know, a memoir like Kara's and say, oh, that's a, you know, that was her experience. That was a one-off experience, and kind of brush it off in a way and, you know, do the same thing with Lauren's. But my hope is that by providing this wider lens, you can see it's not, it's not a one-off thing. And there are actually systemic issues that make this a very common story for a lot of girls and women.
Yeah. That's the sad truth that right there. All right, it's time for a quick break to hear from the brands that allow us to bring you this free content. Please consider supporting them as they support us. We'll be back soon.
So, Christine, it's fairly well known that women have been disproportionately underrepresented in scientific research in general. So I can only imagine how much more disparity there is than when it comes to sports science. Tell us what that looks like.
It's wild. So the most recent numbers I've seen are, you know, between 2014 and 2020, only 6% of research studies focus specifically, or of sports science research studies focus specifically on women. And women comprised only 34% of the participants in these studies, which in and of itself is just shocking, because that's 2020, right? Like, that's not that long ago. But what's even more shocking to me is, so of the 94% that focused on men, of those studies, only, gosh, I'm going to get the number wrong now, but it was something like 0.5% or something like that. Or no, it was 0.6% of those studies investigated something that was unique to men. So that meant like over 99% of those other studies could have involved women, but didn't. So it's, you know, it just speaks to this huge gap in the research field. But I also think it just speaks to these blinders that exist within the system of scientific research, right? Because it's always been done this way. It's always been, you study men, you know, that's the population you go with. That's where you learn stuff. It doesn't, we don't really need to study women because they're, you know, they're essentially the same. Just get rid of the reproductive organs, right? Or women are too complicated to study because of our menstrual cycles and hormones. So, but just the way that the field has grown up has made it so that that's that standard methodology. And once that becomes standard, it gets passed down, right? Like, it gets passed down from, you know, the head of the labs to the students that they're training. Those students then go off and, you know, start their own labs and they train more students, right? So it's a huge trickle-down effect. And when it just becomes the thing that you do, there are lots of blind spots to who you are leaving out. You don't even question it or start to think about it. And so I don't think that it's malicious on any one scientist, any one institution, that they are deliberately trying to leave women out. But I think that it, again, it's this system that's grown up and the way that we do things that it has created these blind spots.
Yeah.
So, Christine, then what are some of the many ways that women athletes have been impacted by this gap in sports science?
So, on a very practical level, that means that women don't have access to the same level of training and nutrition guidelines, injury prevention protocols, even gear and clothing as boys and men, because it doesn't fully reflect not only their physiology, right, but their lived experience. And you could just take an example of, say, the sports bra, right? the sports bra wasn't invented until 1977. It was like, you know, height of the jogging boom, but there was nothing to help control breast movement until these three women in Vermont decided to sew two jock straps together and create something. But because the researchers, right, the biomechanics researchers were mostly men, and the bra designers, who are also mostly men, didn't really think about breasts and breast motion when you're being active, they never studied it. And so if you don't study it, you can't create a garment that can adequately control that movement, right? Because you don't have any of that information. Well, first, you're not even just paying attention to the issue, but then you don't have any data or information to help you design a good garment. And it really wasn't until 2000s, 2010s, when researchers really started to study breast biomechanics in earnest. And it's not just that breasts go up and down. Like, they go up and down, they go in and out, they go side to side. Like, it's a very complicated movement pattern, you know, that someone described to me as, like, you know, almost looking like butterfly wings, right? which like makes sense. But because of that, you know, I think most of us with breasts and who are active can say that sports bras have sucked, right? Or like have been terrible for so long. And it's only recently that a lot of these brands are starting to incorporate this type of research into their research and into their design process in order to make better garments. And it's not like a trivial concern. Like, breast pain, like, so many people experience breast pain. Breasts are a huge barrier to physical activity, like, especially for younger girls. I think, like, for adolescents, it's like 1 in 2 said that breast pain is, or breasts and concerns about their breasts are a barrier to physical activity. So if that's the case, and girls and women are not given the garments that can work for them, and you're not comfortable, then of course you're not going to want to go out and play, right? Or of course you're not going to want to go out and run. And so it creates this like self-perpetuating cycle in a way. So, I mean, that's one example. I mean, the other examples you could look at really, you know, if you think about things like concussion symptoms, concussion has been primarily studied in boys and men who are playing football or soccer or, you know, any other sport, lacrosse. But concussion symptoms may be different between boys and girls and men and women. And so in the same way that we've seen with cardiovascular health and heart disease, right? Like, where heart attack symptoms in men appear one way, but they might appear in a different way in women, that same thing can happen with something like concussion. And so if you're not recognizing those symptoms, you're not flagging those kids as potentially being concussed and making sure that they get to care within a reasonable time. And the research has shown being able to get to medical care quickly makes a huge difference in your concussion outcomes.
Mm. Wow. As the mom of a daughter who plays on a co-ed soccer team, and she got a severe concussion, I guess about a year ago, it was scary. And so what you just said really hits home with me. Wow.
It is really scary, right? And, you know, how can... I don't know. It just comes back to, for me, like, girls and women, I mean, everyone really deserves better, right? And like, we are doing a disservice to like half the population because we say that women are too difficult to do research on.
Sad. So you share several examples in your book about how this has played out for women athletes. Some of the outcomes are truly awful. And so could you share the story of a female runner who suffered the consequences of the sports science gap?
Yeah. So one of the stories I talk about in the beginning, I believe in the introduction, is Leah Falland, who is a professional track and field athlete. She graduated from Michigan State. She was a great athlete in college, never injured. Was supposed to be, you know, one of the greats and like one of the next greats. But she's kind of ended up having all of these injuries after college, you know, a bunch of bone stress injuries, but could never find the right doctors to help her, you know? So not only, so she would get injured, come back, get injured. You know, there was a lot of issues, turns out, with like hormonal health and thyroid, and I think thyroid. But, you know, in terms of her underfueling herself, but no one was putting together these pieces in a holistic way, right? They didn't know how to look at her as an athlete and as a woman. And at one point, she ended up spending, I think it's like $15,000 out of her own pocket trying to find answers, right? Because like, and she's young. She was like in her early 20s and she had all this potential and she's, you know, driving around thinking, I don't know if I can make it back. I don't know if I'm ever going to run again. And it breaks my heart that, you know, I'm sure that her story is not uncommon, right? And just thinking about all this potential we might lose because we don't know how to take care of our girls and women. And we don't know how to treat them first and foremost as human beings, but then also, right, like in a female body, as an athlete, what are we missing here? Eventually, you know, she was able to kind of turn some stuff around. She actually just had a baby recently, which is fantastic. But yeah, it's wild because it's never, I think, especially in our healthcare system in particular, we look at everything in such small silos, right? Like you have a bone stress injury, so you're going to go see your sports medicine doctor or orthopedist. You have maybe struggling with some nutrition stuff, so you'll go see a sports dietitian. Maybe you're missing your period and you're talking about that with your OBGYN, but no one is talking to each other, right? And all of those things in your body are not happening in isolation. They are all feeding on each other, but we don't look at people that way.
Definitely. So give us a little bit of hope here. And how do you see the picture starting to change and who's driving that change?
Yeah, I mean, I do have a lot of hope. And just in seeing all of, even in, you know, the last couple of years, just all this interest in female athlete related research, I think that there's been, you know, it almost feels like a light bulb moment, right? When people are like realizing that, oh my gosh, why haven't we been studying this? And we need more work on this. So both interest from the scientist researcher side, as well as from the general public, right? Like I think a lot of women are just hungry for more information because, I mean, you just realize how little you do know about your own body, right? So I think that there's a lot of hunger. And so those things coming together has really pushed, you know, the research agenda forward for more research around female athletes. And we need that. We need to build a strong evidence base to really understand what's going on, right? To really even know what questions we should be asking, because we're really starting from scratch in a lot of ways. So I have a lot of hope in that. And there's so many amazing people working on this. You know, there's folks like Kate Ackerman over at the Boston Children's Hospital, who is the director of the female athlete program there. There's, you know, folks like Emily Krauss out at Stanford, who's leading like a similar initiative out there, really also focused on trying to translate a lot of the research into educational things, right, for the general public so people can understand what the research is actually saying. So Emily is working on that with like Megan Roche, and they're doing fantastic work. There are programs like at the Hospital for Special Surgery. They have a women's specific sports program there that's similar to the program up in Boston, is this interdisciplinary program that brings together the sports medicine doctor, the orthopedist, the endocrinologist, the sports nutrition, like all these folks under one roof who work collaboratively with patients. So again, you start to break down some of those silos that we see in more traditional healthcare settings. So it is really exciting. And then on the other side of things, I just look at the amazing young athletes that are coming up, mostly at the collegiate level, but they're so outspoken too. And they are not afraid to advocate for themselves and to say, you know what? We deserve better. We deserve a culture of mm-hmm. sports that's better. We deserve to be treated better. And that's really heartening to me. I mean, one, because I could not imagine doing that, you know, at their age. I was just trying to survive college, I think. But to to be so vocal and outspoken about some of these issues has been really kind of amazing to see and gives me a lot of hope.
Do you see, though, you earlier on were talking about how part of the problem that this has just been baked into the system, and so that's how medical students learn about things from their predecessors, and then they turn around and probably teach their younger colleagues the same sort of thing. Do you see there being work in the system to kind of break this cycle? And then the other concern I have is listening to you cite examples of people who are doing this fabulous research. Unless I'm mistaken, it sounds like it's a whole lot of women. Do we think there's any men leading the charge in this?
So I'll answer the second question first. There are amazing men doing the work.
Okay.
There's, you know, Trent Stellingworth up in Canada is such a phenomenal advocate for all of this work. And he is very involved in a lot of the research as well. AC Hackney, who's a professor at UNC. I mean, he's been studying this since the 70s. You know, so again, it's not to say that there hasn't been any research in the past. It's just that in comparison, right, it's been so little. And it's, you know, we need to kind of continue that to build that momentum and to build that base so that you have a strong foundation, right, to draw from. But yeah, but he's been doing this work since the 70s and studying it and really looking at the effects of hormone on exercise response and training and performance and all of that. In terms of your question about what's happening inside the house, there is a lot of work. There's, you know, there are calls amongst the researchers to standardize protocols and definitions, which I think is a big piece of it. Because when you aren't using similar definitions, say for like menstrual cycle, you know, what each menstrual cycle phase means, or even your methodology is different. If you're kind of testing hormonal status, are you using self-reports? Are you using saliva? Are you using blood? You know, all of those things matter because then affects whether or not you can compare study to study, right? Mm-hmm. And the quality of the study. And if we do want to get to something that's evidence-based and we can using consensus statements and all of that, you have to be able to compare those studies to draw those larger conclusions. So if we start to standardize some of those methodologies and protocols, you start to hopefully increase the quality of those studies, right? I think the other kind of knock-on effect of that is that, you know, the traditional argument against including women, like I said, is because women are complicated, and scientists would then need to account for the menstrual cycle. And that has always seemed like kind of intimidating. And I can imagine it being intimidating especially if I was a newer scientist, right? Like, what do I do? How do I do this? So again, by kind of standardizing some of this stuff, I think it makes, you know, doing this work maybe a little bit less intimidating, right? So that people, you know, almost have the stuff, the formula, the recipe, if you will, for how to do this. And they don't have to try to figure it out from scratch. And I think that's one of the other pretty amazing things I think about the folks who are working in this field is that they are so collaborative and not just, you know, kind of on the surface level. Like working so well together and sharing findings and, you know, really pushing each other, I think, forward. And as a result, that's going to push the field forward.
Well, speaking of hormones, we realize that folks are at a lot of different stages of life. And we know menopause is a hot topic for a lot of our listeners. So I want to touch on that. Toward the end of your book, you write, the truth is that your prime active years don't have to coincide with your fertility. Menopause opens up a new chapter of your active life, not the inevitable beginning of the end. As our population ages, are you at all optimistic that more research will be done on this topic too?
Absolutely. Again, because I think as In part because the researchers that are involved in this, so like, you know, the Kate Ackermans, Christy Elliott Sale out in the UK, they're also at this age, right? In this life stage where they're going through this too. But, and they are all athletes and they have these questions. So they want to know. So, you know, they're pushing forward and really focusing on a lot of research around the menopause transition and kind of what that means. Of course, the frustrating thing about science is that it just takes time, right? Like to do the studies, to analyze the data, to publish the results. So, you know, unfortunately, it's not something that we'll learn about or we'll have conclusions about like tomorrow. But mm-hmm. I am confident that, you know, we will get more information hopefully soon.
Hmm. Well, Christine, thank you so much for speaking with us today. And I really hope everybody picks up your book Up to Speed because it is fascinating. And like we were talking about earlier, it really offers a framework for understanding so many of the other topics that are being discussed in the running world right now. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for being interested in it and, you know, really enjoyed chatting about it with you and Amanda.
Great. Great. Take care and good luck with the launch of your book.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, I don't know about you, but I feel like, first of all, I just learned a lot. And second of all, you know, Christine's really doing all of us a big service with this book.
I know. And just, I think everything that can be done to push this ball forward on the field is something we all need to work on. And
absolutely.
Yeah. So, oh my goodness. And maybe the research can't come soon enough for all of us, but you know, let's hope that it can get to a place where it's integrated into our healthcare system and the bigger picture by the time some of our children become women and go from there. Yeah. All right. Well, we appreciate you being a loyal listener, and we'd love if you could help other folks find our podcast. It's easy to help. Go to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and rate us, hopefully with 5 stars, and then write a quick review. Ratings and reviews truly help new listeners find us and trust that we're a good running companion. It also assures potential advertisers that we have a strong listenership. So please show your support by rating and reviewing us wherever you get podcasts. We're mighty grateful. Our podcast today was produced in St. Paul, Minnesota by Barry Medour from Fire on the Bluff. My dad was a very cautious man, and he was all about putting your hands out in front of you when you fall. And so always like telling us not to carry things, you know, because what happens if you trip and, you know, then you can't.
Get your hands out.
You have to throw the cake in the air to get your hands out in front of you. Oh my goodness.